Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, guest host Sam Smith speaks with historian Mark Levine about musicians and human rights in Israel. But first, experts say Yemen is the worst humanitarian crisis in modern history. Warnings from the UN say the death toll from starvation could reach 18.4 million by the end of the year. Why is this happening and what can be done? We're joined by two experts.
Dr. Charles Schmitz is a professor of geography at Towson University in Baltimore and the co-author of the Historical Dictionary of Yemen. He served as a past president of the American Institute for Yemeni Studies and is an affiliated scholar with the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Hamoud Salhi is a professor and dean of undergraduate studies at California State University at Dominguez Hills. He is also a host of Swana Regional Radio on KPFK in Los Angeles and a frequent media commentator. So welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the two of you back here to talk again about a really sad situation in Yemen. I understand it is potentially the worst famine we've faced in modern history in 100 years, they're saying. I guess the most important place to start is, what is it that we're facing, Hamoud? What's happening in Yemen?
A lot of things are happening in Yemen. There is one on the battleground where the Saudis are continuing to bomb. And this is more devastating than before. There is the humanitarian crisis. I think catching up about 75% of the population, and the situation is getting worse and worse. And there is an issue on the back of everybody, perhaps, is the water issue. Some reports many years ago were talking about how Yemen will be the first country to run out of water by 2025. That 2025 is not that far away. So there is a crisis there in addition to the humanitarian things that's happening. Second thing on the political side, on the region, we've seen some movement since, number one, President Trump gave a warning, or somewhat a warning to the Yemenis and the Saudis to sit down together and work a resolution or a ceasefire, and the meeting was scheduled in Sweden. Well, yesterday we heard that the House declined or rejected the proposal that the Democrats submitted months ago about using the War Powers Act to bring Americans from hostilities area, namely Yemen. So the House is now, the Republicans are against it. They are not going to pursue with that. And this is the same thing would happen in the Senate because the same proposal was there. What was interesting about the proposal in the House is, if it passed, it would have given a chance for the American public to actually hear something, a hearing, or the entire chamber about what's the United States involvement in the region, in Yemen. Now, internationally, there is a movement by the UK Foreign Minister, Jeremy Hunt, who has been pushing to hold the Swedish meeting scheduled to be sort of held by the end of the year. Remember, initially, we had a meeting that was supposed to be scheduled in September in Switzerland. That didn't happen. There were several reasons, but one of them is that the Houthis did not agree to the preconditions that were set according to, I think, United Nations Resolution 2216. One of them was specifically stated that the Houthis must cease hostilities, give up arms, give the equipment to the Saudis and the Yemeni Hadi Mansour government. So there were conditions on them, and in fact, the resolution was biased to that degree. So Jeremy Hunt is very active in building what he wants, what he describes as mutual confidence measures. He has got the Saudis and to agree to allow the Houthis to take some medical evacuation, and that is sort of in line what the Houthis have been asking. There is a discussion about a political solution and another discussion about the humanitarian crisis. What's very interesting is that Sweden has been lobbying since back in April or for March and worked very hard in the United Nations Security Council to organize an event like this, and specifically to address the two issues that seems to be dominating perhaps these negotiations. The last minute, which is very, very important, the last important thing is that, remember, the Saudis and the Emirates are aligned in this conflict. They are against the Houthis, but there is a bit of a change of heart among the Emiratis. The Crown Minister Zayed was in Riyadh 2 days ago, and he met with everyone, about 15 princes and the king, except he didn't meet with Mohammed bin Salman. And that was interpreted as a way of showing that the Emiratis are not happy with the murder of Khashoggi. What's been interesting is that the Emirati media, which has been sort of supportive, implied support for the Saudis during this visit and after, the media, particularly the Arabic media, start to talk about what they describe as a bad way of handling a crisis in reference to the Khashoggi. So there is a change in the opposition between the Emiratis and the Saudis. So there are a lot of things happening. I don't know what we're going to focus on.
Well, that's actually a good look all the way around. Charles Schmitz, let's bring you in. You and I were talking ahead of the recording about some of these matters as well. What would you add to this?
I would add that the refocus on the humanitarian crisis is because of the battle for Hodeidah. Yemen imports 90% of its food grains, and Hodeidah is the last port that the Houthi control. The UN had pressured the Saudi Emirati-backed forces from going into the city. And when the talk of new negotiations, when the Trump administration and Mattis made clear that they wanted an end to the war by the end of the month, the Saudis and the Emiratis pushed into Hodeidah. They actually took the battle into the city. The concern is, number one, the residents of Hodeidah fleeing, and that's causing the population of Hodeidah is about 700,000 people. Half the city has fled already. There are street battles going on in Hodeidah. And so there's the question of the displaced people, but actually more importantly is the possible destruction of the infrastructure, which is critical for getting supplies to Sana'a, to getting the supplies to the Western Highlands that the Houthi control. Now, just today, the Emirati and the Saudi-backed forces have pulled back, and they're no longer fighting. They appear to have stood down. The second thing I would add to the humanitarian crisis is that the Yemeni economy for the last two decades has been highly dependent upon oil. And during the war period, oil exports have stopped. The Emirati-backed government in the south, the Hadi government, has managed to make just a few recent shipments of oil out. But really, there are no revenues. The revenues available to the Yemeni government are near what they were before. And therefore, the economy has collapsed. And a big part of the humanitarian crisis is simply the fact that people don't have any money. I mean, people haven't been paid for 4 years. And all of the spillover effects on the rest of the economy means that there may be supplies in the market. People don't have the means to buy it. Add to it that the rial has collapsed. I mean, the rial was about 250 to the dollar when the war started, and it's reached 700 now. And that means that the price of everything imported goes way up. So these things, internal displacement, the war in Hodeidah, the collapse of the economy, these are the things that are driving the humanitarian crisis.
I read in some of the news articles that adding to that humanitarian crisis is that some of the bombing targets by the Saudis and its allies were food supply, fish markets and...
I know in particular that some of the grain facilities in the south, in Aden, were hit initially. That was in 2015 when the battle for Aden was going on, that they hit those. And the Saudi campaign did attack basic transportation infrastructure. So they hit bridges on key roads and things like this that has made it much more difficult to get supplies around. So that is part of the crisis. But I would say that the biggest factor driving the humanitarian crisis is the collapse of the economy and then the issue of displaced people, people that are fleeing the conflict.
Hamoud Salehi, let's bring you back in on this. Now, how did we get to this point Is there a deep history that we need to understand in order to trace to its source why this conflict is even happening and how it's led to this?
There is something about Yemen, just to put it in the context, and this is where we could see the Saudi Arabian role in this. Back in 1981, as an example, when the Gulf Cooperation Council was created, there was a discussion about including Yemen in the council. The current GCC, or Gulf Cooperation Council, is only composed of the monarchies and the emirates, namely the six Gulf countries, not Yemen. At that point, the discussion was that Yemen had a different political system. But there was also concern deeper than that. There was a concern that the Yemeni population was too big for the Saudis to be greater than the GCC. And more than anything else, there is a sense in the Gulf that there is some kind of discrimination against the Yemenis. They were always viewed as less of a national or a nation. They were mistreated. They work as second citizens in all the GCC countries. They are never seen as sort of equal to the GCC. That's the background to this. The second background to this is not the first time that Saudi Arabia is involved in this. The whole Yemen was divided between Marxists in the south, and that led to war, remember, in 1990, and then 96 you had the Union. And that war, it was split between the Marxists in the south and the north, the pro-monarchies. During the Arab nationalist era in 60s and 50s, the Marxists were supported by Gamal Abdel Nasser, the Arab progressist leaders of the time, the so-called progressists or nationalists, and against the monarchs who were seen as living in the north. Now, the other factor is that Yemen is a society that is rooted in tribalism, and there are huge differences between the city. Everybody is poor, relatively speaking, but there is more differences between the south and the north and within the cities and the rural areas. What is very interesting is that the rural areas were ignored in the 90s and up to early 2000. And the ads at one point, I'm not kidding about this, the ads in eight travel agencies in the 90s used to run as a promotion to their vacations in Yemen, an idea or a prospect of being kidnapped by terrorists in Yemen. Now, there was a fact about it, that the Westerners will travel to Yemen and they get kidnapped by whoever it is there, usually tribalism or somebody. And that kidnapping was used to force the government or the local authorities to build a road, for example, to open schools. And it was through those means, through kidnapping Westerners, that some infrastructure was developed. This is to show the extent to which there is this maldistribution of wealth. Behind the scene of this conflict, yes, there is this economic class differences, tribalism, but there is also a distribution of power, maldistribution of political power. In the draft of the constitution that was discussed and that rejected by the Houthis, it was clear that the group of Hadi Mansour and backed by the Saudis were going to get the share of the most important powers. The Houthis objected because just of that. They felt that if they are part of this constitution and they are treated equally, they should have equal powers. So there was some pressure to get, for example, certain ministers for them. So there is this historical problems that exist for so many decades. And when you couple with what the Arab Spring happened, or the so-called Arab Spring, and you factor in the Saudi involvement and the Emiratis, and then you factor the Iranians, then Yemen become a center for the Saudis and the Iranians to fight their wars outside their borders. Now, the biggest challenge today is both in Saudi Arabia and in Yemen, they are using external threat to legitimize their action internally. The debate in the Saudi Arabia today is that there is an external threat to the Saudi Arabia, and that diverts the attention away from the internal problems. The killing of Khashoggi, the imprisonment of many Saudi citizens, and Khashoggi is just one example of those. But by creating a place, a conflict outside, projecting the Iranians as a threat helps them. The same thing with the Iranians. Just the last point, how this is significant. When we look at the debates in the 90s in the Gulf region, when Mohammed Said Khatami was in power and he set a rapprochement policy towards his neighbors. Remember, during Khatami's era, every Arab GCC state except Yemen had opened up to the Iranians. In fact, Prince Abdullah, the late Prince Abdullah, and Khatami were so close that there was discussion in the media about a Saudi-Iranian pact. The discussion at that time in the Gulf countries was not by the external threat, but the discussion shifted to democratization. So it was during this time that the Qataris started to talk about drafting a constitution. It was during this time that the Emiratis start to form democratic or so-called democratic local legislative elected officials. And the Saudis broadened the council of consultative council. The point is this. When you have no external threat, the shift becomes more to internal politics. What's happening in Yemen and Iran is another, in Yemen, and the fight over the region between the Saudis and Yemenis is an extension of that diversion, of that public attempts to distract us away from the internal problems.
So it sounds really complicated. Charles Schmitz, would you agree with Hamoud's assessment? And would you add anything to that?
Yeah, I would agree. I've been approached by Saudis saying that, well, you know, we have to be involved because the Houthi are threatening us with missiles. And I point out that the Houthi didn't fire any missiles until after the Saudis started bombing. So it was kind of a product of their own aggression in Yemen. And it is very true, as Hamoud says, is that both sides, the Houthi frame their politics around defending Yemen from foreign aggression. And so they've been able to mobilize a much broader constituency because they say they are the ones that are able to maintain Yemen's sovereignty. And the Saudis always point to the very few missiles that the Houthi have shot. They may have gotten Iranian help in developing those capabilities. It's not clear. But the Houthi developed those capabilities precisely to be able to threaten the Saudis. I mean, they have nothing. The Saudis have absolute air superiority in Yemen, and the Houthi have no defense against the bombardment. And so developing the missiles gives the Houthi a card. And I say that, you know, the first step in any resolution of this conflict is going to be a rapprochement between the Saudis and the Houthis in which they come to some agreement over security. And they did this. They did this in the spring of 2016. They got as far even as the Saudis sending some relief supplies directly across the border to the Houthi areas in the north in Saada. But that agreement was scuttled. I believe that agreement was scuttled because Ali Abdullah Saleh was not part of it, and he undermined it. So that, to me, is the key to resolution of the conflict. I might add that, as Hamoud was saying, Yemen is very different than the Gulf states. There are more Yemeni nationals than there are nationals of all the Gulf states put together. And Yemen is very poor, and the Gulf states, of course, are quite wealthy. And so the Saudis, their real goal is to be the most dominant foreign power in Yemen. They see Yemen as a threat. They see Yemen as a threat either as Yemen imploding and poor Yemenis pouring across the border, or Yemen imploding and terrorist organizations, Al-Qaeda, using, and they have used Yemen as a base to come in and attack Saudi Arabia. Or they're also afraid of a strong Yemen. They're afraid of a Yemen united, a strong state that could represent a threat to Saudi Arabia as well. And so what Saudi Arabia would like is kind of a Yemeni state that's halfway, that can maintain the internal control, that can provide enough growth so that people are relatively satisfied, yet won't be strong enough to actually threaten the Saudis themselves. And so the Saudis want to be the most dominant foreign power in Yemen. They don't want any other foreign power meddling in Yemen. And so the fact that the Iranians have some role, as small as it may be, but just the fact that the Houthi are talking to the Iranians, this is the threat. Let me say that the real threat for the Saudis is not so much the Iranians, it is that the Houthi are independent. And once the Houthi can come into conversation with the Saudis and deal with them, which they can do, I have no doubt they can do that, then this conflict will start to stand down.
You know, it's interesting, Charles Schmitz, that you mentioned that the Saudis don't want Yemen to implode. And yet it seems like that's exactly what's happening with the Saudi push.
That's a good point. My understanding is that the Americans were not happy at all with, they were aware that the Saudis were preparing this campaign, but they were not happy with it because they felt that it was ill-prepared, it was ill-planned, and it would not reach its objectives. In other words, the Saudis, I think, believed that, you know, their air campaign would, in a matter of months, even weeks, would bring the Houthi to their knees and change the equation. And it just didn't. And, you know, most outsiders said that it wouldn't as well. I mean, the Houthi fought 6 years of insurgency against the Yemeni government. So they're very experienced as insurgents. In fact, that's their best position, is to be the underdogs in a battle. They know how to do that quite well. And so, in effect, the Saudis have reinforced what are the Houthis' best attributes or their best capabilities. So, yes, it is, in a way, backfiring. But that's because it was an ill-conceived plan. And to connect that back to bin Salman, he staked his reputation on this. This is the first time that the Saudis used the military to this extent. I mean, they did use it in their military in Yemen in 2009, very little. Minimally, they used their military in Bahrain in 2011 to crush the Arab Spring there. But this is the first sort of large scale Saudi involvement, and it's going badly, and it's making bin Salman look bad as well.
So you started to talk about what it would require to resolve this crisis before tens of millions more people die. What do you propose?
Well, the first thing that needs to happen is the Saudis and the Houthi need to reach a security agreement. And this would involve an ending of the bombardment and an ending of the missile attacks. And those two cards, one for the other, that would assure the Saudis, and it would bring the Houthi into negotiations. The next step after that is the rest of Yemen, because the southern, eastern, and now in the Hodeidah region, these are regions that are under Emirati, and they're nominally under the Hadi government. And those are all Yemenis that are opposed to the Houthi. And then there needs to be an agreement between them and the Houthi to create a political process to move forward. And what has been said again and again and again is that there needs to be a government of national reconciliation in which Hadi is out. In other words, Hadi has been the representative of one side, and the Houthi would have representation in this government, but it wouldn't be a Houthi government. It would be a national reconciliation government. And that government could begin to see de-escalation within the country and provide a means, a political means, forward with some kind of elections or something like that. A sticking point is the Constitution. As Hamoud said, the Constitution calls for a federal division of Yemen into six districts. Both the Houthis and the Southerners reject those divisions. They feel that those divisions were created precisely to harm their interests. And so there's going to have to be a renegotiation of that document. But that could be done under the National Reconciliation Government.
Well, that sounds like there's possibility of resolution. Hamoud, are you optimistic?
It's really hard to say. On the one hand, yes. And maybe that's my natural optimism. The other thing is that I think what you've been seeing is you have an interest by its outside powers, namely the involvement of the United Kingdom, the United States to a degree. We still have to figure that out, and international public pressure. I feel this has to lead somewhere. There is a possibility that a settlement or resolution, at least partially in transition, could be worked out. I am tempted say that the meeting in Sweden could be key, in particular because of the role of the major powers. And here again, this is not a call to add a new United Nations Security Council resolutions. But I think part of it, there is a sense, particularly from the Saudis and the Emiratis, that perhaps it's time to get out from this conflict and find a resolution. But does this mean that we are going to have the proper deal? I think we are not going to have the proper deal because the Houthis will not settle for a resolution that will not be sort of acceptable to them in ways that they appear or become, they lose leverage on anything of the sort that would not make them in a better or at least the peace is appealing. They are not going to give up for anything. The Saudis at the same time, the Saudis has a lot to lose in this case, and the Emiratis as well, in part because there is the image of Saudi Arabia. There is also the military cost that this conflict is costing them. And then the reputation or the role in the whole Arab world. The discussion in the Arab world today is focusing more on the Saudis being more of a player or a country that is promoting a policy that is in line with Israel, that is in line with the United States, and anti the Arab people. This change of language or narrative has a very, very important impact in the psyche in Saudi Arabia. And related to that is that there is, I think at one point or another, the older leadership in Saudi Arabia and the Arab Emirates will step in. What we've seen is that this is a new generation that is sort of not politically savvy. Mohammed Salman is in his early 30s. Abdullah bin Zayed, I think the foreign minister or one of the leader in the United Arab Emirates who is behind foreign policy, is in his mid-30s. And, you know, the Crown Prince, Zayed in his early 30s, even Mohammed, the leader of Dubai and the first minister of the UAE, is in his 40s. We lost that old liberation, old leadership, Faisal or Zayed and Nahyan. That leadership used to think strategically. They were interested in the Arab Brotherhood. And I think this leadership, this young leadership who is becoming stronger and stronger and just thinks that doesn't appeal to the vast majority of or the tradition in this region, may see itself creating a problem for their longevity. And what we've seen with how Mohammed bin Salman is acting, the imprisonment or taking people in a hotel and making them do things that, come up with a bribe, give them money or anything to combat what you call it, a bribery or being a transparent, all of those kind of things, doesn't bode well with the Saudi or the Gulf countries. These are secret societies that prepare to keep their internal conflicts inside rather than outside. The Yemen seems to put that sort of in the open. I mean, when you look at the foreign policy of United Arab Emirates prior to this case, they were the quietest, the more rational, the stable. Now the United Arab Emirates is meeting with the Israelis. They are in other countries, invading other countries specifically. That doesn't go well with the leadership, the nationals in this country. So that's why I am optimistic, because it's as if its leaders are experiencing what it takes to take actions that are in line with the tradition or what has been sort of accustomed. One would hope that there would be a solution. And I think this Sweden meeting is a good opportunity to set a path for how perhaps de-escalate the conflict or put a path for peace. And all the discussion, I think, at this point is leaning toward that path. Whether it's successful or not, it certainly will be a long road and it will take a long time.
Well, thank you so much, Hamoud Salhi and Charles Schmitz. It's been a great pleasure hosting you. I really appreciate your wisdom on this and sharing your research. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Dr. Charles Schmitz is a professor of geography at Towson University in Baltimore and the co-author of the Historical Dictionary of Yemen. He served as a past president of the American Institute for Yemeni Studies and is an affiliated scholar with the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Hamoud Salhi is a professor and dean of undergraduate studies at California State University at Dominguez Hills. He is also a host of Swana Regional Radio on KPFK in Los Angeles and a frequent media commentator.
When we come back, a reflection on musicians and human rights in Israel. Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Lord, Elvis Costello, and the Pixies are among the musicians who canceled their performances in Israel. Sam Smith interviews Mark Levine, professor of history at UC Irvine, about musicians, cultural boycotts, and the BDS movement.
I'm joined by Professor Mark Levine from the University of California, Irvine. He has written extensively about the BDS movement and Israel, as well as how music can influence social and political change. How are you going, Mark?
I'm doing wonderful. Thanks so much for having me on.
So I guess a good place to start would be, how did the BDS movement develop?
The BDS movement, in my experience and understanding of it, really emerges out of the failure of other aspects of the nonviolent movement of basically civil resistance against the occupation in the occupied territories to achieve any kind of long-lasting success. And I think what people need to understand is that for decades, Israel has specifically targeted nonviolent activists in the Palestinian community for arrest, torture, deportation, etc. So in the context of the impossibility of engaging in any kind of civil resistance and nonviolent resistance against Israel on their own, Palestinians started looking to other examples of how groups that were being oppressed used international solidarity to strengthen their position. And of course, the most immediate historical precedent was the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. First of all, because it was one of the most successful movements against colonization and against widespread and institutionalized discrimination, and also because it had only worked a few years before. So it was still very fresh, and Mandela and the new South African system was an example of how this kind of activity could work. So it was both a reaction to the success of the brutal method used by Israel to suppress any kind of nonviolent resistance to the occupation, and the success, on the other hand, of the South African model of fighting against apartheid using international solidarity actions that were based around BDS.
And what exactly is the movement's scope and goals, I guess?
There are several major components of BDS. First of all, we have to understand what each means. There's a boycott, then there's a divestment, and then there's sanctions. So there are three separate components. A boycott, of course, is to, on the one hand, if you're talking economically, refuse to buy certain Israeli products. For some people, the boycott means refusing to buy products that were made in settlements, so made in the occupied territories, but in Jewish settlements or Jewish-run businesses in the occupied territories. Seems like a great idea, and almost every sort of liberal person supports that because most people admit that the occupation is illegal under international law. The problem is that the occupied territories have become so integrated into Israel, it's more or less impossible to differentiate or separate companies that do business in the occupied territories and Israeli settlements with the larger Israeli economy. And that, of course, has been precisely the goal of the occupation and the settlement enterprise. So because of that, BDS movement has more or less targeted all Israeli products for boycott on the argument that the entire Israeli political, economic, and cultural system is involved in the occupation. Therefore, you really can't make a distinction between the West Bank and settlements in the West Bank and Israel proper. So that's the economic boycott, but the boycott also goes for artists and academics, are the two other components. One is to get artists to stop performing in Israel, except under very limited circumstances, and that would be circumstances where the locations they are playing are what would be termed BDS compliant. In other words, there are locations which are either owned by Palestinians, even Palestinian Israelis, or somehow completely separated from the larger Israeli Jewish Zionist cultural system. That's on the one hand. And then on the academic side, it is to refuse any collaboration or cooperation or taking money from any Israeli academic institutions that are complicit with the occupation. And unfortunately, in Israel, almost every major academic institution is complicit in the occupation. They give special considerations and scholarships to soldiers. They give their wholehearted support to the military, even when it's engaged in massive invasions and violations of human rights and civil rights of Palestinians and others. So it is not an individual boycott in the academic case, but it is a refusal to collaborate with Israeli institutions. And in some cases, depending on what institution you're talking about on the Palestinian side, there's also a determination that they will not work with Israelis in any way that would normalize Israeli-Palestinian collaboration, because they spent a decade doing that in the 80s and 90s on the assumption it would help change Israelis' perceptions and help lead to peace. And in fact, it achieved none of those things. And even as they were engaging in quote-unquote people-to-people interactions, Israel was deepening its settlements in the occupied territory. So that's sort of the boycott aspect. Then you have divestment, which is quite simple. Refuse to invest in or do business with corporations that support the occupation. Some of the most famous ones being Hewlett-Packard Computers, which has sold a lot of equipment to the Israeli security services and military. Caterpillar, which designs bulldozers, which are used in home demolitions and things like that. And also refuse to, you know, divest from stocks and other securities or bonds that support the occupation in any way. And then sanctions is to push for the world community at various levels, from national governments to NGOs to international courts to the UN, to sanction Israel, to punish it for the occupation.
Let's turn to the cultural boycott aspect, and in particular, in relation to music and musicians and encouraging musicians not to perform in Israel.
Sure.
How effective has this been?
It's really hard to know. I think it depends on what you mean by effective. I don't think, and I've been working, you know, with Palestinian and Israeli musicians for 25 years. So I've been doing this since well before anyone thought of a boycott idea in that sense. And I think no one who supports the boycott would say, oh my God, it's a huge success in terms of stopping musicians themselves from performing. Right? The majority of musicians probably still perform. For every person like Lord, even a young person who is as aware and as absolutely courageous as she is, there are 20 people who either don't care, too ignorant, or even if they might care, their management and labels and business advisors don't want them anywhere near the boycott movement, not just because it's Israel, because it's not just about Israel. You know, most people in the record industry, like every other industry, care about money. And even if the artist wants to do the right thing, the artist, especially when they become well-known, is so shielded that they don't even get anywhere near this argument, because their management teams and economics people keep them away from it. And I've seen this not just in Israel, for example. In Morocco, some of the most famous artists in the world constantly go to Morocco to perform at these festivals. And even when the Moroccan government is engaged in serious crackdowns, even against artists, jailing artists and things that should raise the ire of any self-respecting musician, some of the most famous musicians in the world have been in Morocco performing and refused to even say a word about it. So, again, it's not just Israel, right? This is a global problem of musicians not supporting their own, and even more so, not taking a stand for human rights if it interferes with their bottom line. On the other hand, what the boycott has done, and this was clearly the overall goal, is force the issue to constantly be discussed of really what's happening there. And if that's all it does, even if, you know, only one out of 50 artists who are pressed to boycott actually boycott, the fact that each time it forces into the public consciousness the debate over the occupation, then that's a really big success, given A, the stakes involved, and B, how powerful the Israeli propaganda machine still is to change the subject or suppress any kind of critical discussions of Israeli policies.
So what can be done to convince more musicians not to perform in Israel?
This is really like the civil rights movement in the U.S. or, I don't know, the New Zealand experience, as much as I know the Australian experience with Aboriginal peoples. It takes decades, first of all, to build a consensus among people among artists and among the world community that the people who are the objects of this oppression are actually fully human and have the same rights as everyone else, and that their rights are being violated. Because most people don't want to admit that, because then they have to admit their own implication in the violations. So the single most important thing is education. When you think about, let's say, a band like Radiohead, theoretically are a progressive band, supposedly nice people, and yet when they were pressed not to play in Tel Aviv, came out with stuff that, you know, was about as factually challenged as the average day for Donald Trump. When a band like Radiohead can show itself to be that ignorant about what's really happening, if someone goes back and reads Tom York talking about why they understood what was happening, one of their members is an Arab, even though they're not. They were actually a Jewish Arab Israeli, which is very different than a Palestinian. When you're dealing with that level of ignorance, the amount of work you have to do is immense. And the other issue is, and it's very important, and this is where BDS folks have to still do a better job and develop the discourse more, is that, you know, musicians today more than ever make their living touring. And if you tell a musician you can't go to countries to play that oppress people, then of course they can't go to Russia, they can't go to China, they can't go to, you know, half of Africa, they can't go to the United States if you want to make a case, a country that oppresses people, right? You certainly shouldn't go to Australia, given, you know, the ongoing disastrous treatment of migrants, which is a violation of international law against Aboriginal people. In that sense, most physicians say, I can't even go there, because if I start with Israel, where am I going to end? And then I'm going to wind up having to basically give up my career. So if we're going to answer that, we need to do a much better job of articulating why the Palestinian case is in a way unique. And it is unique, not in that Palestinians suffer uniquely, which is certainly not the case. There are people who suffer even more, like in Yemen or a few other places, not many, but a few. It's the case that Palestinian civil society decided, after years of debates and arguments and thinking this through and experiencing and trying every other way possible, that BDS is the best way the world can help them at least have a chance not to just completely be pushed aside into history the way too many indigenous peoples have been. And because of that, we as artists have a special responsibility to take that request seriously. Whereas other places where there's a lot of oppression, and even more oppression perhaps, you haven't had artists and civil society there make that same request for many reasons, right? And if they did, we would have to respect that too. The good news I would like to just say is that now, and I know this from just being there a few months ago, you have people within Palestine, within both the occupied territories and also within Israel proper, who are starting to figure out more ways that people can come to Israel and play, but play at alternative venues that don't support the occupation. So playing in Haifa or Nazareth or places that have a far larger Palestinian population, and in venues that are owned by Palestinian Israelis and so on, or venues that are clearly owned and worked on by activists who really are completely separate from the machinery of the occupation. So BDS is evolving too, and one could actually see in the next few years it evolve into not don't come to Israel to play at all and make money off the occupation, but if you're going to come, go to these venues that actually support Palestinians in their struggle rather than supporting the occupation. That's probably going to be more of the future of BDS than just a straight boycott. But again, as Israel becomes even more racist, if we're being honest with the new nationality law, and Palestinian citizens themselves are being marginalized more, that might prove to be an impossibility as well, in which case then the existing BDS will probably continue and be strengthened.
We've had a situation in New Zealand recently where two activists have been sued for helping convince Lorde to pull out of her shows. What do you make of this situation?
I can't imagine that the Israeli government imagines that they're going to collect on this. To me, this is like Trump. This is basically, you say and do the most inflammatory, ridiculous things possible, because in so doing, you increase the hatred, you increase the vitriol, you increase the conflict, because the more of that there is, the easier it is for you to continue the policies you're doing. It's ludicrous. I can't imagine the New Zealand court would ever back this Israeli thing, because of course it's utterly ridiculous. The one thing that any government or country that is engaged in this level of human rights abuses systematically needs to do. And this kind of demonization and this kind of dehumanization, again, as we see in my own country, the only way that continues is if you keep people constantly on edge, constantly fearful, constantly angry, and constantly fighting. So the Israeli government will do everything it can to make the price of BDS as high as possible to scare off people in the future and keep their own people inflamed. And of course, it's the goal of everyone who opposes that to keep the solidarity strong, as, you know, has clearly happened, to beat them, you know, with a kind of jujitsu rather than a direct frontal assault, which those two young women are brilliant, and the way they've turned it into a support campaign for Gaza is just, you know, even, I mean, it almost makes the whole thing worth it. And, you know, it just shows you how the struggle is going to be play out in the international arena, even as Israel continues to, you know, increase settlements, to build new settlements, to tighten its grip on the occupied territories. And that's going to be really the struggle for activists, is how do we not get so caught up in defending against this kind of nonsense, which then drains all the air out of the room, so we don't even have time to continue to talk about the occupation.
Some have accused the BDS movement of silencing musicians and censorship. What do you make of this argument?
First of all, I have to say that there's no such thing as one unitary movement that everyone speaks with the same voice and no one goes off on their own, or in fact, so I'm sure if you look throughout the entirety of BDS supporters, there might be people who say that. I've never met one, but I'm sure somewhere someone might exist. But by and large, and in the vast majority of cases, that's just ludicrous, right? In fact, BDS, as someone, I've been involved in this for decades, right? And I found the greatest actual collaborations between Israelis and Palestinians have been precisely inside the BDS movement, among academics, among activists, among artists and musicians. Because that act of solidarity creates a strength of relations that is really, anyone who's not been in a struggle like the anti-apartheid struggle or the anti-racist struggles elsewhere really can't understand what happens when people from the dominant society make the commitment to really work fully for the liberation of the people their country is oppressing. Once you do that, then you enter a whole different kind of relationship with those people. So I have never seen any case of that in my experience since the beginning of BDS about 13, 14 years ago. I see artists who are being asked to learn what's going on. No one's being told, don't come to Israel. They're saying, don't come to Israel and make money at our expense and art wash our occupation. Right? Jello Biafra, the great punk singer, you know, really epitomizes. He was going to play Israel. He hadn't really thought it through. He was contacted by BDS. He's a man of great integrity. He thought about it. He said, instead of just saying, screw you, or saying, okay, I won't go, he didn't go to perform. He went to learn instead. He traveled, he learned, and then he realized that they were right. You know, so I far from being an act of censorship, BDS is an opening for discussion. And let us remember that the Israeli government only survives by censorship. It censors Palestinians every day. It censors Palestinian artists every day. It oppresses and represses free speech by Palestinians every day. Palestinians who speak out are jailed, shot, tortured, killed every day for 50 years by the Israeli government. This is not I'm not making claims here, I'm stating empirical facts. So when people say that the BDS movement is somehow censoring musicians, it's just ludicrous. It's absolutely ludicrous, especially in the context of an Israeli state that daily denies Palestinian artists the right to travel, denies them the right to perform, targets them, beats them, humiliates them, jails them, even kills them, that denies Palestinian students the right to go to school, the right to an education, the right to travel abroad, and so on and so forth. To then say that those who oppose that are engaged in censorship is, you know, Orwellian. It's just, It's just utter fabrications. Again, I'm sure there are some people who support BDS, even musicians, who are racist, who hate Jews, whatever. But the vast majority of people who support BDS, who increasingly include many, many, many Jewish artists and academics and others. So it's not just, Jews are as fully a part of this movement as white South Africans were crucial to the success of the anti-apartheid struggle, right? So this idea is just simply a lie.
Do you think in boycotting or not playing Israel, musicians can help create awareness around the situation in Palestine among their fan base who may not be aware of what is happening?
You know, there's several levels of how this would work. And again, I have to say I'm not, an official representative of the movement, and I don't necessarily agree with everything that everyone else who's in it. I mean, there are a variety of opinions. But the first thing is, don't play Israel under the present circumstances in a way that supports in any way this process, right? The occupation and the ongoing disenfranchisement of millions of Palestinians. Now, if a musician simply does that, that's great. You know, Bruce Springsteen, for example, I don't think he's actually ever played Israel, and he has not come out and said he was, supporting BDS, but he's never gone, and certainly, given who goes to Israel, the size of the artists who go, U2 and Madonna, et cetera, Radiohead, it's certain he could go there and people would be ecstatic. So the fact that he hasn't gone there is clearly somehow tied to Israeli policies after all these years, but he just doesn't go, and that's enough for him. And he doesn't really talk about it, he just doesn't do it, which I'm sure is good enough. But other artists like Roger Waters or Brian Eno, are very committed to the cause, and they use it directly to educate their fans and to educate other artists. So I think there's a spectrum of people who decide not to play. I think those who are making the choice not to play, should talk to their fans about it. They should educate themselves. No one should not go just because they feel pressured. They should not go because they've looked at the situation and understood the arguments and the realities and said, I support this because I don't want to be supporting oppression. But I do think, even though Palestinians have a particular claim to BDS because it's become a kind of national strategy, I think artists should think a lot more carefully about where they play and how they play and who they're playing benefits, right? So I think BDS is not the end of the story. I think it's the beginning of the story of artists taking a much more active role in using their art in socially and politically responsible ways that further the single most important function of art in society, which is to, at least to me as an artist, which is to help lead to greater solidarity, greater awareness, and greater freedom. I think in that sense, people who want to embrace BDS shouldn't be scared, and they shouldn't just limit it to Palestine. They should really think about how they as artists can function in a world where artists more than ever today have an outsized social role and more than ever are being used by governments all over the world as a way of co-opting and naturalizing policies which have no business being naturalized.
Just one final question, moving forward into the future, where to next for the BDS movement?
First of all, I should say, I'm not any kind of representative for the movement, so I'm just looking at it as someone who's been involved in my own work since the beginning. I think obviously each of the three components has its own course or courses to take. So the boycott movement, if you're talking about with artists, or the academic boycott, they are, even though they're generally grouped together, the academic and cultural boycott, each one will progress in its own way, because the conditions under which both artists and academics operate inside Israel and the occupied territories is not identical. So as that changes, you will see the movement respond, and you will see artists adapt. And divestments, I think, will continue to try to build up the momentum. We've seen in the U.S. and Europe, churches and unions and others, divest from owning Israeli stocks and stocks and companies that support the occupation. So that's going to slowly grow over time. And then the sanctions movement is really the most difficult one, because as long as the existing system of international law is in place through the UN and you have a Security Council where the U.S. has a veto, basically it's almost impossible to sanction Israel in any major way. So that's going to be the most difficult. There was an attempt to use Europe as an alternative to the international arena, but it's pretty clear that the EU doesn't have any stomach to punish Israel in any meaningful way. So that the sanctions part, I don't know how that evolves. But specifically, if we're just talking about musicians, I think as it develops, and as Israel continues to become more and more a blatantly racist state against Palestinians, you're going to see more and more Israeli Jews give up on Zionism, essentially, as a white ethno-national, you know, movement, and embrace a kind of binational or democratic ideal. And as that happens, that's really going to create the tipping point where international artists are going to find it much harder to perform as usual in Israel, and more Israeli artists are going to have to choose between their position as artists who are progressive and as Zionists who support a racist government and an illegal occupation. And that, I think, that tipping point, which I see happening much more in academia so far than in the arts, but it is happening more and more. And at some point in the next 10 years or so, if nothing changes, you'll probably reach that tipping point where the majority of Israeli artists are no longer Zionists, because they simply can't be artists and be chauvinist and racist. And when that happens, I think you'll see a real change in the way the cultural boycott movement works. And you'll also see more Palestinian institutions developing who can offer alternatives. So I think you're really going to see an evolution over the next decade or generation, because the occupation shows no sign of ending. And if it's going to continue, the attempts to resist it are going to continue as well.
Mark Levine, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.